Chapter 17. In the days following the battle with the pirates, as the Indian vessel made its slow way across the Erythraean Sea, much changed. Not the sea itself, nor the wind. No, the southeast monsoon maintained its unwavering force, fierce and blustery. Quite unlike, Garmat assured the Romans, the pleasant and balmy monsoon which would bear them westward some months hence. And the sea seemed always the same, as did the dimly seen coastline to their north, the coast of Persia now, for they had crossed the Straits of Hormuz, leaving Arabia and its dangers behind. The same also was Aeon's daily grousing on the subject of landlubberly Indians, and his advisers' frequent comments on the contrasting habits of such true seafaring folk as Ethiopians and Arabs, and Greeks, of course, who eschewed the creeping coast and set forth boldly across the open ocean, and the inevitable remarks which followed from Usanas on the inseparable bond between seamanship and braggadocio. But everything else changed. The first change was in the attitude of Venan de Catra toward his guests. The Indian grandee lost not a trace of his hauteur and his cold, serpentine arrogance, but he no longer ignored the foreigners. Oh, no, not at all. Daily he came to visit, trailing a gaggle of priests, spending at least an hour at the bow in discourse with Belisarius, Aeon, and Garmat. The others he ignored. They were but common soldiers, or, in the case of Usanas, the most grotesque slave in creation. Daily also, he invited Belisarius and Aeon, and grudgingly Garmat, to dine with him in his cabin that evening. The invitation was invariably accepted, by Belisarius eagerly, by Garmat dutifully, by the prince with the sullen discipline of a boy hauled by his ears. The general's eagerness for these evening meals didn't arise from any pleasure in Venan de Catra's company. In person, in private, the Indian lord was even more loathsome than he was at a distance. Nor was Belisarius's enthusiasm occasioned by the meals themselves, though they were truly excellent repasts. Belisarius wasn't a gourmand, and he had always found that the most important seasoning for food was good company at the table. The meals served in Venan de Catra's cabin were splendid, but they were seasoned with a spiritual sauce so foul it might have been the saliva of Satan himself. Neither was the general's joy in these social encounters produced by any misreading of Venan de Catra's motives. Belisarius knew full well that the sudden Malwa hospitality didn't result from gratitude for the decisive role played by Belisarius and his men in the battle with the pirates. No, the truth was quite the opposite, and Belisarius knew it as surely as he knew his own name. Venan de Catra's new cordiality was the product of the battle, true. A product, however, which was born not of gratitude, but fear. Venan de Catra had never witnessed Romans in combat, nor Axumites. Now he had, and knew them for his future enemy, and knew, with that bone-chilling certainty known only by those who have actually seen the mace-crushed skulls and the spear-sundered chests, and the guttering blood and severed limbs, that his enemy was terrible beyond all former comprehension. What had seemed in the conspiring corridors of Malwa palaces and the scented chambers of Malwa emperors to be a surety of the future seemed so no longer. Rome would be conquered and enslaved, but it would be no easy task, nor a simple one. And so, Belisarius knew, Venan de Catra made his daily visits and his daily invitations to dinner. Just so does the cobra raise its head and swell its hood and flick its tongue and sway its sinuous rhythm, the better to put its prey into a trance. And just so joyfully does the mongoose enter the trap. Crooked as a root was the mind of Belisarius, and now, finally inside the gnarls and twists of his peculiar mind, a plot was sprouting and spreading. The growing plot was as cunning as any stratagem the general had ever devised, and he was a man who treasured cunning much as another might treasure gold, or another the beauty of concubines. Of itself, however, the cleverness produced only satisfaction in the heart of Belisarius, not joy. No, the joy derived elsewhere. The joy, it might be better to say the savage and pitiless glee, derived from the fact that the entire plot pivoted on the very soul of the man against whom it was aimed. The Vile One, Menandakatra was called, and it would be by his own vileness that Belisarius would bring him down. So every day on the sunlit bow of the ship, Belisarius greeted Menandakatra with cordiality and respect. So every evening in the lantern gloom of the cabin, Belisarius returned the grandee's slimy bonhomie with his own oily camaraderie, the lord's lecherous humor with his own salacious wit, and the flashes of Malwa depravity with glimpses of his own bestial corruption. The shrewd old adviser Garmat, under other circumstances, would have reacted with still-faced, diplomatic, silent disgust. The impetuous and elephant-hearted young prince with words of scorn and contempt. But the circumstances here had changed also since the battle, and this change was no product of guile and duplicity. Before the battle, true, Romans and Axumites had been on good terms. Caleb had made clear to Aeon and Garmat in private council after they returned to Axum in the company of Belisarius the importance which the Nagusa Nagast attached to forging an alliance with Rome. It was for that very reason that he had assented to their proposal to accompany the Byzantines to India, perilous though such a trip might be for his young son. Belisarius, though he carried no such precise and definite imperial instructions, had his own reasons for seeking such a bond. Already, if only an outline, he was shaping the grand strategy of Rome's coming war with the Malwa Empire. The role of Axum in that conflict would be crucial. His cataphracts and Aeon's Sarwen, experienced soldiers, had quickly detected the attitude of their superiors, and had shaped their own conduct accordingly. Menander, on his own, filled with the thoughtless certainties of youth, might have given vent to certain prejudices and animosities, but not with the two veterans watching him like a hawk. So, during the many months prior to the battle with the pirates, in the company which they shared through the trip to Syria and the sojourn at Darius and the voyage to Egypt and then to Adulis, through the trek up country to the city of Axum, through the lengthy stay at Axum itself, through the return to Adulis and the embarkation aboard the Malwa vessel bearing its envoys back to India, the Romans and Axumites had maintained their good relations and the disciplined propriety of their conduct. So they had. But still, they were each foreign to the other, for all that the Ethiopians spoke good, if accented, Greek, and the Romans began to speak poor and very accented Ge'ez. To be sure, no words were ever uttered which might have given offense, save by Usanas, of course, but since the Dawaz insulted everybody equally, including tribes and nations no one else had even heard of, his outrageous behavior soon became accepted, much as one accepts the rain and the wind and noxious insects. But through all the months of joint travel and mutual goodwill, there had not been much in the way of open trust and confidence, and even less in the way of genuine intimacy. Now, all that was changed. Since the battle, all former propriety and stiff good conduct had vanished, like it had never existed, especially among the common soldiers. In its place came insults and derision, mockery and ridicule, grousing and complaint. In short, all the mechanisms by which blooded veterans seal their comradeship. The Sarwen were no longer nameless. The one whose black skull had gained a new scalp scar in the battle was named Ezana, the other Wasi. The Romans now learned of a long-standing Ethiopian custom. The true name of a Sarwen was never told to any but members of the Sarawit, lest the warrior be subject to sorcery from his enemies. Upon receiving acceptance from his own Sarwe into its ranks, an Axumite boy was given the name by which he would henceforth be known in private by his comrades. Shortly after the battle with the pirates, in their own little ceremony held where the lords were carousing with Venandakatra, the two Sarwen officially enrolled the three cataphracts into the ranks of the Dakuan and spoke their true names. The Roman soldiers thought the custom odd in its particulars, but they didn't sneer at it, for they found nothing odd in the general thrust of the thing. Valentinian and Anastasius carried about their persons various amulets and charms with which to ward off witchcraft, and Menander, through the long bouts of fever and delirium produced by his wound, never once relinquished his grip upon the little icon which he had been given the day he proudly rode off to answer the summons of his lord Belisarius. The village priest who gave him the icon had assured the young cataphract that it would shield him from evil and deviltry. And it most surely did, for the youth recovered did he not? And from a wound which, in the experience of his veteran companions, Roman and Ethiopian alike, almost invariably resulted in a lingering death from hideous disease. Truly an excellent icon. But, excellent icon or no, some of the credit for the young Thracian's recovery was surely due to the Ethiopians. To their strange and exotic poultices and potions, perhaps, to the comfort and companionship given him through the long, pain-racked days and nights by the less seriously wounded Ezana, certainly. In time, young Menander came to speak Ge'ez fluently, and more quickly than any of the other Romans. The lad's speech, moreover, was afflicted with almost none of the horrible accent which so disfigured the Ge'ez of all the other Romans, except Belisarius, of course, whose Ge'ez was soon indistinguishable from a native. But Belisarius was a witch. In his time, Menander would become the most popular of Roman officers, among the Aksumite troops with which his own forces were so frequently allied. And in a time far distant from the disease-infected agony of that wound, the cataphract would finally return to his beloved Thrace. No youth now, unknown to all but his own villagers, but an iron-haired warrior of renown, who bore his fame casually in the pleasant years of his retirement, and saved all his pride for his great brood of dark children and his beloved Ethiopian wife. Ezana, too, would survive the wars. From time to time, the Sarwen would come to Thrace to visit his old comrade Menander, and the half-sister who had become Menander's wife. Ezana would bring no great entourage with him to Thrace, though he himself was now famous, and such a retinue was always offered to him by the Negusinagast. Simply himself and his own collection of scars and memories. In that future, Ezana would enjoy those visits immensely. He would enjoy watching the sun set over the distant mountains of Macedon, his cup in his hand, the company of Menander and his half-sister, their great brood of attentive offspring, and the even greater horde of scruffy village children for whom Menander's modest estate was a giant playground. And the memories. Sad memories, some. Wasi wouldn't survive the wars. He would die in a sea battle off the coast of Persia, his body unrecovered. But he would die gloriously, and his name would remain, carved on a small monument in the African highlands, spoken in prayers in a quiet monastery in Thrace. Always, in those visits of the future, the time would come when Menander and Ezana would remember that ship on the Erythraean Sea and speak of it. At those times, the children would cease their play, grow silent, and gather around. This was their favorite tale, and they never tired of it, neither they nor the old veterans who told it once again. Menander's wife tired of it, of course, and grumbled to the village matrons who were her friends. But the men ignored the grumbling with the indifference of long experience. Wives were a disrespectful lot, as was known by all veterans. The children who listened to the tale loved all the parts of it. They loved the drama of the sea battle, the dragon fire and the boarding, the cut and thrust at the bow, and especially the charge to the stern led by the legendary Belisarius. Oh, marvelous charge. And if the description of the fury at the stern bore small improvements to the uncouth truth of history, there was none to set them wrong. Ezana said nothing while Menander embroidered just a bit the tale of his great wound. Here, as always, the children would demand to see the grotesque scar on his belly, and Menander would oblige. The sword which caused that wound had become, through the transmutation of veteran tales, the blade of a mighty Arab warrior who overcame, through his legendary cunning, the skill of a valiant young Roman foe. There was nothing in the tale now of the confusion of inexperience in the chaos of battle, and the sheer luck which had enabled a nameless and unknown pirate to stab, without even knowing his exact target, a brave but clumsy novice. No, Ezana said nothing. Nor did Menander speak when, in the course of the tale, Ezana came to show his own honorable scar. The Sarwen would bend his head here that the eager children might gather and spread the mat of kinky gray hair, and shriek with delighted horror as always. Menander said nothing of what he might now, from the experience of the many battles which had come after. He said nothing to the children of the panic which he knew had filled Ezana's heart at that moment, blood-blinded in the midst of murder. No, Menander held his tongue. There was no purpose in antiquarian pettifoggery. Perhaps the children would never need to know such things. Menander and Azana had done all they could in their bloody lives to ensure that they wouldn't. And if, in the course of time, some of the children learned these ancient lessons for themselves, well, best they came to the lesson filled with the innocent and simple courage imparted by veterans' tales. But for all their infantile bloodlust, the children's favorite part of the tale was always the aftermath. The story of those wondrous days when the seeds of that Roman-Axumite alliance, which the children accepted as the nature of their world, first bore fruit. The days when a comradeship was forged, a comradeship which had long since entered the legends of Thrace and Ethiopia, and Constantinople and Rome and Arabia and India come to it. Above all, the children loved the tale when it finally told of the night when great Belisarius first spoke to that company of heroes of his purpose and his mission and his quest, and bound them to it with oaths of iron, of the rise of Satan and the warning of a monk, of a captured princess and a hero to be found and a dagger delivered, and the talisman of God. They would tell the tale anew, would Menander and Azana, and tell it well, each augmenting what the other forgot or misremembered. But even in that practiced telling, the minds of the two veterans would drift and wander back to the time itself. They would tell the children and hold back nothing, for there were no secrets now to be kept from Satan and his hosts. The hosts were gone, and though Satan was not, the monster was paralyzed for a time, chained in the pit and gnashing at his own terrible wounds. No, they would hold back nothing, but the children would never truly understand the tale. The children would understand only the grand adventure and the glory of Belisarius and the faithful heroism of his companions. They would never understand the heart of that moment, that night when Belisarius bound his brotherhood, the sheer, pure, unadulterated wonder of it. Another change had taken place the day after the battle. At Belisarius's request, firm request, but there had been no need for belligerence, Venon de Contra had agreed to provide his guests with quarter in the hold below. Heretofore, the Romans and Axumites had been forced to make their quarters on the deck, sheltered only by their own tents. In truth, neither the Romans nor the Ethiopians had minded the previous accommodations. Except for Belisarius, in fact, none of them had given the matter any thought at all. Sleeping on deck was the normal procedure in those times when traveling by ship. Few vessels were of a size to provide enclosed sleeping quarters for any but the captain. Decent quarters, at any rate. Common sailors often slept in the hold, under conditions which were so cramped and noisome that passengers would have recoiled in horror. For all its size, the Indian craft wasn't much different. In his cabin amidships and the smaller cabins which adjoined it, Venon de Contra and his priests enjoyed comfortable surroundings, luxurious ones in the case of Venon de Contra. The officers of the ship and the commanders of the Malwa and Yetai troops also possessed small cabins of their own located in the stern. As for the rest, the soldiers enjoyed the comparative comfort of the deck, accepting the elements as the price for relative spaciousness and fresh air. The common sailors festered in the hold. But there were a few quarters available for Belisarius's company. A storage cabin was found in the bow, whose contents could be removed. Foodstuffs in the main, amphorae filled with the grain and oil out of which the common fare of the soldiers was prepared. Some of the amphorae were stowed elsewhere, including all of the oil. Many of the amphorae filled with grain were simply pitched overboard. The amphorae were crude and cheap, and the extra grain was no longer needed due to the heavy casualties suffered by the Yetai in the battle. Belisarius's companions hadn't been filled with joy, actually, upon learning of the new arrangement. The storage cabin was filthy until they cleaned it, and rat-infested until the weapons of Cataphract and Sarwen were put to inglorious use. True, they were now sheltered from the wind and the rain and the sea spray. They were also sheltered from clean air and sunlight, and crowded as badly as if they were in a dungeon. And if the seeping planks of the gloomy cabin were any less damp than the deck above, it wasn't noticeable to its disgruntled inhabitants. But the general's companions made no objection after they gave the matter a bit of thought, for the storage cabin in the bow had one outstanding feature which they knew was Belisarius's purpose in obtaining it. privacy. Belisarius had needed that privacy 2 nights after the battle when his small company had settled into their new quarters. He had things to tell and a thing to show, which no Malwa must hear or see. For that purpose, the storage cabins served to perfection. Much better, in fact, than would one of the comfortable cabins amidships. The storage cabin was isolated, far distant from any Indian sleeping or feigning sleep, and easily guarded from spies and eavesdroppers. It was in those noisome surroundings, thus, that Belisarius imparted his great secret to his companions. He did so with neither reluctance nor hesitation, nor now simply from a sense of obligation or a need to forestall rumors of sorcery and demonism. Those reasons remained, of course, but his overriding purpose in telling his companions his secret was that he now had a plan, or at least the beginnings of one. It was a plan which would require their combined efforts to succeed, and would, moreover, require several members of his company to do things which would seem utterly bizarre unless they understood the reasons which underlay them. And for that, they needed to know the secret, not so much for its own sake, but for the sake of his stratagem. In some strange manner, in the very fury of the battle, the framework of his plot had come to him, had sprung into his mind, actually, in mid-stroke of his sword. Later, so magical had that moment been that he had suspected the jewel was its cause. In the quiet hours which followed, he had probed the barrier relentlessly, but the jewel had reacted not at all. It was exhausted again, he realized, and with the realization came an understanding of just how feverishly the jewel had worked to augment his senses during the battle. It was that augmentation, he thought, which had produced the sudden image of his stratagem. The plan was his, not the jewel's. The jewel was responsible for it only in the sense that his efforts had enabled his mind to work in such a wondrous manner. He understood, too, that the human subtleties and nuances, which were the essence of his stratagem, were utterly beyond the capabilities of the jewel. For now, certainly, perhaps always. And so it was, in the gloom and stench of a taper-lit storage cabin, that Belisarius introduced his comrades to glory and wonder and terror. He told the tale first, all of it, from its very beginning in a cave in Syria. He stressed that the jewel had originated with Michael of Macedonia, and had been brought to the general with the blessings of that monk and the bishop Anthony Cassian. For his cataphracts, he knew, those names would bring great assurance. And he thought the Ethiopians would take comfort in them also. True, none of the Ethiopians had probably ever heard of Michael of Macedonia or Anthony Cassian. Still, they were Christian folk, even if they were heretics. Monophysites, essentially, though not without their own stiff variations on that creed. As it turned out, Garmat was quite familiar with both Michael and Anthony, by reputation if not by personal acquaintance. Belisarius suspended his tale for a moment upon that discovery, allowing Garmat to inform the other Ethiopians of the nature of those persons. Aeon and the Sarwen seemed suitably impressed. Thereafter, Belisarius spoke without interruption until his tale reached the present moment. He withheld nothing save the subtleties of his standing with the emperor. He saw no need to involve his companions in that delicate matter. It was enough to speak of his meeting with the Empress Theodora, that part of the meeting, at least, which dealt with India, and to remind them of the emperor's official blessing for his mission. He suspected that Garmat understood quite a bit more of the maneuverings of the Byzantine court, but the advisor said nothing. No one did, after Belisarius finished. The crowded cabin was utterly still. Oddly enough, it was Menander who finally broke the silence. The young cataphract was very weak, but quite alert. The fever and delirium which all veterans knew would soon be produced by his abdominal wound had not yet made their appearance. "May I see it?" whispered Menander. There was nothing in his voice of the young warrior, just the awe of a village lad. "You may all see it," replied Belisarius. The general reached into his tunic and withdrew the pouch. He spilled the jewel into his palm and held it out. All save Menander leaned forward to see. A moment later, the young Thracian's shoulders were gently held up by Ezana so that he too might observe the miraculous sight. Miraculous indeed. Weary, A might have been, but had understood the importance of the moment and drew the facets to itself. The jewel did not blaze here, as it had once in Belisarius's villa in Antioch. There was no energy for such a solar display. But there were none in the cabin, gazing upon that shifting and flashing wonder, those cool, translucent combinations of every hue known to man and many never seen before, who doubted for one moment that they were witness to a miracle. Eventually, Garmont spoke. "It is not enough," he whispered. Belisarius cocked his eyebrow. The advisor shook his head, not in an unfriendly manner, no, but in a manner which bespoke no deference either. "I'm sorry, Belisarius. I do not distrust you or what you say, and the jewel is certainly as awesome as you described. But..." Garmont made a gesture which encompassed the ship and everything in the world beyond it. "What you say involves not us alone, but those to whom we are responsible." "You want to touch the jewel yourself?" said Belisarius gently. Garmont shook his head, smiling. "Certainly not. At my age, terrible visions are the last thing I need. I've seen enough of those already." Belisarius shifted his gaze, and subtly his hand, to the prince. "Aeon, then." The prince stared at the jewel, his brow furrowed with thought. Thought only, however, not fear. So much was obvious to all who watched. Belisarius wasn't the only one present then who saw the adult majesty of the future in that dark young face. "No," said Aeon finally. "I don't trust myself yet." He turned to Usanas. "Take it."
"Why me?"
"You are my Duaz. I trust you more than any man living. Take it." Usanas stared at his charge, then, without moving his eyes, extended his hand to Belisarius. The general placed the jewel on his palm. A moment later, the Duaz closed his hand and left the world for a time. When he returned and opened his eyes, he seemed completely unchanged. The others present were a bit surprised. Belisarius was astonished. When the Duaz spoke, however, the general thought he detected a slight tremor in his rich baritone. His first words were to his prince.
"Always Duaz wonders and fears."
He took a deep breath and briefly looked away.
"No longer. You a great prince. King at the end."
The Duaz fumbled for words.
"Oh, stop speaking pigeon," snapped Aeon.
Usanas cast him an exasperated look.
"It was your silly idea in the first place."
The Duaz glanced at Garmont unkindly.
"Then you backed him up."
Garmont shrugged. Usanas grinned at the Romans. That much, at least, hadn't changed, not the grin.
"You must forgive my companions," said the Duaz.
His Greek was now perfect, mellifluous and completely unaccented. Belisarius managed not to gape. His cataphracts failed.
"The boy has the excuse at least of tender years. His advisor only the excuse of doddering old age. And of course the fact that he is half Arab. A folk who would rather scheme than eat."
Again the unkind glance, but the glance fell away softening.
"Always an Arab, and a full one at the end. After Caleb died, Garmont, you returned to Arabia. You died well there, in the Nejed, leading your beloved Bedouin against the Malwa."
He shrugged.
"You lost, of course. Not even the Bedouin in their desert could withstand the Indian juggernaut. Not after the Malwa brought the Lachmites under their rule, and broke the Beni Ghassan, and dispersed the Quraysh from Mecca."
"You saw the future, then," said Garmont.
"Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. And it was just as terrible as foretold."
Usanas's eyes grew vacant.
"I saw the future until the moment of my own death. I died somewhat ignominiously, I regret to say, from disease brought on by a wound. No glorious wound won in single combat with a champion, alas. Just one of those random missiles which are such a curse to bards and storytellers."
He glanced at Menander and veered away from the subject of wound-produced diseases. Instead, he smiled at the prince. Your end I do not know, Aeon. I died in your arms in the course of the trek which the surviving Ethiopians undertook under your leadership, south to my homeland between the lakes, where you hoped to find a new realm which might still resist the Marwa, although you had no great hope in success. He fell silent. You speak perfect Greek, complained Valentinian. Osanus grimaced. I suspect, my dear Valentinian, that I speak it considerably better than you do. With all respect, I am the best linguist that I know. It comes from being raised in the heart of Africa, I suspect, among savages. In the land between the Great Lakes, there are at least 18 languages spoken. I knew 7 of them by the time I was 12, and learned most of the rest soon thereafter. The grin lit up the cabin. At the age, that is, when the urge to seduction comes to vigorous lads. My own tribe, sad to say, was much opposed to fornication outside proper channels. Other tribes enjoyed more rational customs, but alas, spoke other tongues. So I became adept at learning languages, a habit I have found it useful to maintain. He pointed at the prince, his finger like a spear. This budding conspirator, this still-sprouting intriguer, this not-yet-genius spymaster thought it would be most clever if, in our travels through the Roman Empire, I pretended to be a pigeon babbling ignoramus from the bush. Unsuspecting Romans, he thought, might unthinkingly utter deep secrets in the presence of a thick-tongued slave. The finger transferred its aim to Garmad. This one, this gray-bearded, not-yet-wise man, this decrepit old broken-down so-called advisor, thought the plan might have some merit. So there I was, trapped between the Scylla of naivete and the Charybdis of senility. He raised his eyes to the heavens. Pity me, Romans. There I was, for months, as cultured a heathen as ever departed the savannah, forced to channel my fluid thoughts through the medium of pigeon and trade argot. Ah, woe. Woe, I say, woe. You seem to have survived the experience, chuckled Valentinian. He is very good at surviving experiences, interjected Wasi. That is why we made him Dawas. The Sarwan exchanged a knowing, humorous look. Osanas likes to think it was because of his skills and ability, added Azana, a derisive bark. What nonsense! He's lucky! That's his only talent. But a prince needs to learn luck more than anything, so we made the savage his dawas. Osanas began some retort, but Belisarius interrupted. Later, if you please. For now there are other things more important to discuss. He turned to Garmad. Are you satisfied? The advisor glanced at his prince. Aeon nodded very firmly. Garmat still hesitated for just a second before he nodded his head as well. Good, said Belisarius. Now, I have a plan. After Belisarius finished, Aeon spoke at once. I won't do it. It's beneath... A sharp slap atop his head by Usanas. Silence is good plan. Good for prince, too. Learn to think like worm instead of lion. Worms eat lions, fool boy, not other way around. I told you to stop speaking pigeon, snarled Aeon. Another slap. Not speaking pigeon, speaking baby talk. All stupid prince can understand. Garmat added his own weight to the argument. Your dawaz is right, prince. The advisor made a soothing gesture. Not the worm business, of course, disrespectful brute. But he's right about the plan. It is good in the main, especially insofar as your own part is concerned. He cast a questioning eye at Belisarius. Some of the rest, General, I confess, I find perhaps excessively complex. Perhaps excessively complex, mimicked Valentinian harshly. The cataphract leaned forward. General, in the absence of Morris, I have to take his place as best I can. The first law of battles... Belisarius waved the objection aside, chuckling. I know it by heart. This is not a battle, Valentinian. This is intrigue.
Still, General, interrupted Anastasius, you're depending too much on happenstance. I don't care if we're talking battles or intrigue or plotting how to cuckold the quartermaster, for that matter. You still can't rely that much on luck.
Unlike Valentinian's voice, whose tenor had been sharp with agitation, Anastasius's basso was calm and serene. His words carried much the greater weight because of it. Belisarius hesitated, marshalling his arguments. This was no place for simple authority, he knew. The cataphracts and the Ethiopians needed to be convinced, not commanded. Before he could speak, Usanas interrupted.
I disagree with Anastasius and Valentinian and Garmat. They are mistaking complexity for intricacy. The plan is complex, true, in the sense that it involves many interacting vectors.
Belisarius restrained a laugh, seeing the gapes of his Thracian soldiers and the glum resignation on the faces of Ethiopian Sawin. Usanas gestured enthusiastically.
But that is not the same thing as luck. Oh, no, not at all. Luck is my specialty, it is true, just as the Sawin said. But the simple-minded warrior, a dismissive wave, does not understand luck, and that is why he thinks I am lucky. I am not. I am fortunate, because I understand the way of good fortune.
The Dawaz leaned forward.
The secret of which I will now tell you. One cannot predict the intricate workings of luck, but one can grasp the vectors of good fortune. All you must do is find the simple thing which is at the heart of the problem and seize it. Hold that. Hold it with a grip of iron, and keep it always in your mind, and you will find your way through the vectors.
Fancy talk, sneered Valentinian. But tell me this, O wise one. What's the simple thing about the general's plan?
He snorted.
Name any simple thing about his plan.
Usanas returned the sarcasm with a level gaze.
The simple thing at the heart of the general's plan, Valentinian, is the soul of Vainandakatra. The entire plan revolves around that one thing, which is perhaps the simplest thing in the world.
No man's soul is simple, countered Valentinian feebly.
Not yours, perhaps, replied the Dawaz, but the soul of Vainandakatra? You think that thing is complex?
Usanas barked. In that single laugh was contained a universe of contempt.
If you wish complexity, Valentinian, examine a pile of dog shit. Do not look for it in the soul of Vainandakatra. He's got a point, rumbled Anastasius.
The huge cataphract sighed.
A rather good one, actually.
Another sigh, like the resignation of Atlas to his labors.
Irrefutable, in fact.
Valentinian glowered.
Maybe, he snapped. But still, what of the rest of it? The prince's part in the plot is simple enough, I'll admit.
A skeptical glance at Aeon.
If, begging your pardon, Prince, the young royal can stomach it.
Now he pointed to Usanas.
But what of his part of the plan? Do you call that simple?
Usanas grinned.
In what way is it not? I am required to do two things only, not more than two. I assure you, Cataphract, even savages from the savannah can count as high as two.
Menander interrupted in a whisper.
Those are two pretty complicated things, Usanas.
Nonsense. First I must learn a new language, a trick I learned as a boy. Then I must hunt, a trick I learned even earlier.
You're not going to be hunting an eland in the savannah, Dawaz, said Aeon uncertainly.
That's right, chimed in Valentinian. You're going to be hunting a man in a forest, a man you don't know, in a forest you've never seen, in a land you've never visited.
Usanas shrugged.
What of it? Hunting is simple, my dear Valentinian. When I was a boy growing up in the savannah, I did not think so. I was much impressed with the speed of the impala and the cunning of the buffalo and the ferocity of the hyena, so I wasted many years studying the ways of these beasts, mastering their intricate habits.
He wiped his brow.
So exhausting it was. By the time I was 13, I thought myself the world's greatest hunter.
until a wise old man of the village told me that the world's greatest hunters were tiny little people in a distant jungle. They were called pygmies, he said, and they hunted the greatest of all prey, the elephant.
Elephants, exclaimed Anastasius. He frowned. Just exactly how tiny are these pygmies?
Oh, very tiny.
Osanus gestured with his hand.
Not more than so.
I know it is true. As soon as I heard the wise man's words, I rushed off to the jungle to witness this wonder for myself. Indeed, it was just as the village elder had said. The littlest folk in the world who thought nothing of slaying the earth's most fearsome creatures.
How did they do it? Asked Menander, with youthful avidness. With spears?
Osanus shrugged. Only at the end. They trapped the elephants in pits first. I said they were tiny, Menander. I did not say they were stupid. But mainly they trapped the elephants with wisdom. But these little folk, you see, did not waste their time as I had done, studying the intricate ways of their prey. They simply grasped the soul of the elephant and set their traps accordingly. The elephant's soul is fearless, and so they dug their pits in the very middle of the largest trails, where no other beast would think to tread.
He stared at his prince.
Just so will I trap my prey. It is not complicated. No, it will be the simplest thing imaginable, for the soul of my prey is in its way as uncomplicated as that of Venhandakatra. And I will not even have to grasp that soul, for it has been in my hand for years already. I have stared into the very eyes of that soul from a distance of inches.
He stretched out his left arm.
There, wandering across the ridged muscles and tendons, was a long and ragged scar. It was impossible to miss the white mark against his black flesh, though the color had faded a bit over the years.
Here is the mark of the panther soul, my friends. I know it as well as my own.
Valentinian heaved a sigh. Oh, hell, I tried.
It was a signal, Belisarius knew. Quickly scanning the other faces in the cabin, he saw that they had joined in Valentinian's acceptance.
Valentinian was even grinning now. The cataphract looked at Ezana and Wasi.
Remember what Anastasius and I told you? He demanded. You didn't believe us after the battle with the pirates.
Wasi snorted.
This is what you meant by your general's famous oblique approach?
Ezana laughed.
Like saying a snake walks funny.
He reached up and touched the bandage on his head.
Still, he added cheerfully, it's better than charging across an open deck.
Belisarius smiled and leaned back against the wall of their cabin.
I think that's all we need discuss for the moment, he said. We'll have time to hone the plan in the weeks ahead.
Osanus frowned.
All we need to discuss? Nonsense, General.
A quick dismissing gesture.
Oh, as to the plan, certainly. Good plans are like good meat, best cooked rare. Now we can move on to discuss truly important things.
His great grin erupted.
Philosophy.
He rubbed his hands.
Such a joy to be surrounded by Greeks, now that I can speak the language of philosophy without that horrid pigeon nonsense getting in the way. I shall begin with Plotinus. It is my contention that his application of the principle of prior simplicity to the nature of the divine intellect is, from the standpoint of logic, false, and from the standpoint of theology, impious. I speak here of his views as presented by Porphyry in Book 5 of the Enneads. What is your opinion?
Another dismissive gesture.
I ask this question of the Greeks present, of course. I know the views of the Ethiopians. They think I am a raving madman.
You are a raving madman, said Wasi.
A gibbering lunatic, added Ezana.
I'm not Greek, growled Valentinian. I've never heard such drivel in my life, rumbled Anastasius. Absolute rubbish. The principle of prior simplicity is accepted by all the great philosophers, Plato and Aristotle alike, whatever their other disputes. Plotinus simply applied the concept to the nature of divinity.
Anastasius's enormous shoulders rolled his head forward.
The granite slabs, tors, and crevices which made up his face quivered with ecstasy.
The logic of his position is unassailable, continued the basso profundo, sounding to all in the room save Usanas like the voice of doom itself. I admit the theological implications are staggering at first glance, but I remind you, Usanas, that the great Augustine himself held Plotinus in the highest regard, and—
Oh, sweet Jesus, whispered Menander, falling back weakly. He hasn't done this since the first day I showed up, the new boy, and he trapped me in the barracks. A hideous moan. For hours. Hours! Aeon and the Sarwen were gaping at Anastasius, much as they might have gaped at a buffalo suddenly transformed into a unicorn. Garmot raised his eyes to the heavens. It is an undisputable virtue of my mother's people, he muttered, that they are poets rather than philosophers. Whatever other crimes they have committed, no Arab has ever bored a man to death. Valentinian glared at Belisarius.
It's your fault, hissed the weasel.
Belisarius shrugged. I forgot, and how was I to know he'd find a kindred spirit on this expedition?
It's still your fault, came the unforgiving voice. You knew what he was like. You knew his father was Greek. You picked the troops. You're the general. You're in command. Command takes responsibility.
Ridiculous, exclaimed Usanas.
How can you say such—
Still, overrode Anastasius. I fail to see how you can deny that Plato's forms must also derive from prior elements.
And now you insult Plato.
How far is it to India? Whispered Menander. Weeks, the way these wretched Marwas sail, groused Aeon. And here the prince launched into his own technical diatribe, which, though it was just as long-winded as the debate raging elsewhere in the cabin, had at least the virtue of being more or less comprehensible, even to landlubbers like Belisarius.